A man has been stabbed to death in Ambervale following what police believe was a neighbourly dispute.
A Perth taxi driver has been bashed and his car stolen during an argument over a cigarette.
It is now well known that the sexual abuse of children has been widespread in the Australian community. Yep. However, the full range of...
All right. Welcome, everybody. Welcome to the session on social capital and workers' comp. The key is, what's the missing ingredient? So hopefully we'll find out what that is by the end of the session. But I'd like to introduce to you our two key speakers today. Associate Professor Allen Clayton. He is an independent research consultant that's worked primarily in accident compensation and injury prevention. Allen holds a honours degree in both law and arts, so it's an interesting combination. He's an adjunct professor in a number of areas, actually, in a number of places, Monash University, also associated with the Institute for Safety, Compensation and Recovery Research. Allen holds a number of other adjunct appointments, including honorary associate at the Centre of Employment and Labour Relations Law at the University of Melbourne, and the National Research University for Occupational Health and Safety Regulation at the ANU. So, thanks for ahead of time in advance for your speech. Also, Dr. Mary Wyatt. Mary is an occupational physician, a doctor with special interests in back pain and work and return to work management. Mary also is the founder, as you can see on the screen, of RTReturnToWorkMatters.org. It's the online resource for people involved with return to work management. Mary works in clinical practice and is a lecturer at the Monash University. Mary is also the chair for the non-profit ResWorks. It's the foundation for research into injury and illness in the workplace. Established almost 10 years ago, 2004, and Mary is also involved with policy development through the Faculty of Occupational and Environmental Medicine. One thing I'm aware of as well for Mary is in the early 2000s, between 2000 and 2005, Mary managed a national early intervention program, which was implemented across a number of large organisations in Australia. So without further ado, please welcome Mary and Allen.
Well, thank you. Whenever you go to a concert, there's the main act and there's the warm-up bands in preparation for that. So I'm actually the warm-up guy on this presentation, and Mary will present on a innovative approach. The beginning of this is that both I and Mary have of the view, and following on what Paul O'Connor said today, that our current arrangements in Australian workers' compensation are largely exhausted and are not working. If we look at the stated aims of compensation schemes of prevention, rehabilitation and compensation, the prevention focus is confused. And I'm not talking about the Occupational Health and Safety Inspectorate, although there are issues with that. If you look at most of the schemes in terms of the workers' compensation scheme itself, they usually point to sharply experience-rated premiums as a way of getting safer workplaces. There is now a huge amount of research. The Institute of Working Health has done a systematic review that experience-rated premiums, while they may have some influence in other areas, have almost no impact upon creating safer workplaces. And on the second thing, that return to work initiatives have stalled, and that's what we'll largely be looking at in this presentation, is return to work. And thirdly, in terms of the compensation arrangements, there was some hope that they would become more harmonised. In fact, what we've seen is an increasing fragmentation. If you look at 2012, New South Wales changes, what one has now is a separate scheme for police, fire, emergency services and others, and another lesser scheme for other workers. So essentially what we need is another way, and certainly what I've been calling for some time is a public health approach to that, where we actually look at the primary, secondary and tertiary prevention aspects in their own rights and how we arrive at that. So the issue of social capital is an interesting and powerful framework in how we might make that change. And in the time available in this presentation, I would simply point to what Klaus Tegnell had done in the creation of Vision Zero in the Swedish motor scheme, where he identified 39 system designers from land use planners, road constructors, vehicle manufacturers, fleet owners. Now 60% of vehicles are bought by fleet owners, and if the fleet owners go to Mr. General Motors, Mr. Ford, and say, we'd like your vehicles, and we'd like them even more, and buy them if they've got side impact protection, curtain airbags and the like, then that is embedded into the production process and passed on to all buyers of motor vehicles. We also have some of the emerging tools, and I would recommend particularly the emerging notion of collective impact. This derived from an article in the Stanford Social Innovation Review in 2011 by John Kanya and Mark Kramer, and provides a very powerful organising tool how efforts can be used to orientate the actors within the system towards the same goal. So in terms of how we have failed in return to work, and most schemes place return to work as one of their highest priorities, this is the Safe Work Australia document released in August, which is the headline measures report. It's a replacement for the Campbell return to work monitor, and it shows the return to work rates. What they ask are two questions. Firstly, 7 to 9 months after the injury, have you done any work since injury? And secondly, at the time of the survey, are you in paid employment? This is the first question, have you done any work? And you can see that it has gyrated between 83 and 87%, so essentially stalled over that period. Why does this matter? Well, there are social and economic imperatives. This will be familiar to a lot of people. You'll have seen Sir Mansell Aylward, the Chief Medical Officer of Wales, who has been here often, and it's also something that is reflected in the faculty of the Australasian Faculty of Occupational Environmental Medicine in their consensus statement on the health benefits of work. There's also the economic imperative. The first of those is from a press release that WorkCover South Australia released in May this year, that in 1 year the total days lost represented 560,000 days. And the second one is from a review, a cohort review done by Russa Kieta and Alex Colley, which appeared in BMJ Open in March this year. A very interesting survey, because they took all claims from the 1st of January 1995 to the 31st of December 2008 and looked at recurrent claims. And what they extrapolated was 189,000 years of productivity lost, but of that, about 104,000 of those years was from recurrent claims. So, social capital. This is essentially old wine in a new bottle, in a sense. If you look at classical sociological texts, you know, from Emil Durkheim, Max Weber, George Simmel, Ferdinand Tonnies, Tonnies' distinction between Gemeinschaft and Gesellschaft, and Durkheim looking at the association between suicide and anomie of social dislocation. These are the precursors. The first use of the term social capital was by L.J. Hannigan, who was the superintendent of rural schools in West Virginia, who in his work in that way looked at what was the difference in outcomes that happened in these remote rural schools. This is West Virginia, so it's Appalachian coal miners, it's poor farming backgrounds, and he found that the outcomes in student performance and the like was integrally related to the degree of community participation in the work of those schools. But the modern concept of social capital derives from the work of three major theorists. Pierre Bourdieu, who's a French sociologist, anthropologist, philosopher, major social public intellectual, who in his 1986 work on the forms of capital looked at the differences between economic capital, cultural capital and social capital. His was a largely neo-Weberian attempt to account for what holds societies together and why particular elites maintain their position. But it was related to that social cohesion. So that's a highly philosophical group. James Coleman, American sociologist, the preeminent sociologist of education, took a highly empirical approach and looked at social capital as the binding glue for social action as mediated through social networks and the like. And the third one, and this shows the influences on other scholars, so Bob Pittman is the third. Bob Pittman's the only one who's still alive. Bourdieu died in 2002 and Coleman in 1995. Robert Pittman's a political scientist at the Kennedy School of Government, Harvard, and initially took an interest in social capital with work that he did with two Italian colleagues who and looking at the activities and the productivity of 20 Italian communes, local government organisations, and found that the performance was very strongly related, when you control for other variables, by the degree of civic involvement in those in the activities of those bodies. He then went on in 1995 to write a very influential article in the journal Democracy on Bowling Alone, which he then converted 5 years later in 2000 into a book on Bowling Alone, which looked at the decline in civic involvement, and he took the motive of bowling leagues, these bodies who, you know, groups who got together each week to do 10-pin bowling activities, the decline of these bowling leagues in conjunction with the increase in individual bowlers. So there are differences of emphases in this work, from the highly theoretical with Bourdieu through the highly empirical with Coleman, and a combination with what Robert Putman has done. And the definition there, which is presented, comes from his 1995 essay, as the features of social organisation, such as networks, norms and social trust, that facilitate coordination and cooperation for mutual benefit. So the element of reciprocity, trust, goodwill, and Paul O'Connor spoke about Owen Woodhouse's thing about the feelings of good people. These are the glue that operate in relation to social capital, and Bob Pittman's contribution was the distinction between bonding social capital, which is the social capital within groups that give them cohesion, support, and facilitate their efforts, and breaching social capital is where the glue which provides the cooperation with competing groups. You can see, you know, Bourdieu's off the map in 1986, but the rise in academic analysis of social capital in relation to human capital and social networks. So it's something that has taken off from the mid-90s and is now an important part of that social discourse. Before handing over to Mary, I'd just like to briefly look at how the concept of social capital, either directly per se or implicitly, has been used in evidence-based research which could provide a basis for policy directions and initiatives. Beginning with the Michigan Disability Prevention Study, which is Alan Hunt and Rochelle Harbeck from the Upjohn Institute in Kalamazoo. The Upjohn Institute was established by W.E. Upjohn, who's concerned about unemployment in the 1930s. It sits on a huge lot of Upjohn, now Pfizer shares, so it can actually conduct its own work without having to find other backers. So the Michigan Disability Prevention Study was a 3-year study involving 220 Michigan firms with over 100 employees, and it constructed 8 measures of performance within these firms, including a people-centred measure within the organisation. And not surprisingly, and probably about 98% of the work we do in this field is not counterintuitive, that the firms that scored high on the people-centred approach had a much earlier and more durable return to work. Members of that study, plus Ben Amick. Ben Amick was then at the University of Texas, is now directing the research at the Institute of Work and Health. Was a prospective study of people in Maine undergoing carpal tunnel surgery, and again found that there was 1.6 times higher return to work with those workers who were injured in a firm which had a high level of people-oriented culture. The next one I'll just mention because it's explicit, Astia Almedan, who's at the Fletcher School at Tufts University, tries to tease out the elements. And in a very short address, one cannot emphasise the degree of highly nuanced and complex elements in this. It's not a simple, concrete, easy to apply concept. And she teases that out. Diana Kenny, in an early study which would fall into the concept of the socio-legal ethnography of the experience of injured workers, was really Diana Kenny's at the University of Sydney, and sat down with the experience of injured workers as to what facilitated return to work and what were the barriers there. The systematic literary reviews, the Institute of Work and Health is the Cochrane Collaboration Centre for Low Back Pain. It's an area which Mary's had a great deal of involvement. And this is an area where evidence-based approach from Alf Nackemson, Gordon Waddell, Rick Deo, and Mary Wyatt has had an influence in reorienting the approach of doctors in the proper treatment of low back pain. They conducted systematic reviews, first published in 2004, and then breaking it out in the quantitative studies and the qualitative studies that Ellen McKechnie had done. So I'll just close by reference to the problem of co-workers or the issue of co-workers and whether to what extent co-workers can be a facilitator or barrier to return to work. And the first one is Iggy Cosney with a number of associates. And again, this is a 2013 study who looked in an article, Buddies in Bad Times, which was a series of interviews with electricians who are injured, and looked at what the pressures and what helped and what hindered their return to work. So the structure of work, the insecurity of work, cost-cutting and competition, and the development of different camps among co-workers were seen as barriers. There has been some very interesting German work which has focused on co-workers, training them up as facilitators of that return to work. And finally, the work of Deborah Dunstan at the University of New England, and again Ellen McKechnie, on co-workers, again looking at what, in terms of return to work reintegration, what the processes of company support, union support and other facilitators of return to work balanced against the nature of the workplace and things undercutting that support. And they have in press at the moment a very interesting work which tries to build a theoretical construct which brings together the empirical work but puts it in a fascinating conceptual framework in order to do that. I'll hand over to Mary.
Thanks, Alan. Alan and I came to this area from two different directions. Alan started, as I understand it, looking at the theory, and we've started with the practical. So I want to talk a little bit about the practical implementation of systems that can help people. The discussion within the workers' compensation sphere can often be about competing interests. This is about the intersection of interests. So social capital is the asset that comes from people working together collaboratively. And one might alternatively look at the cost of people not working together collaboratively. Social capital is a real issue. It is a real asset, and it is one that is often missing in workers' compensation schemes. This morning, while I was getting some coffee, I ran into someone I knew who said, "I hear you're talking about some social issues." Just to be very clear, this is not about social matters. This is about hard outcomes and how we can improve hard outcomes. So this study that I'm referring to was published last year in the Journal of Oc Rehab. Ross Isles is a PhD researcher, and Glenn Pransky is the director of the Liberty Mutual Work Disability Research Centre. And it looks at data from intervention companies, places where this intervention was put in place, and compares to matched control companies, so companies of similar size and industry, and compares the results before the intervention was put in place to the period when the intervention was put in place. What was the intervention? The intervention was really what we often talk about should happen in return to work schemes, but often doesn't. This is nothing new, it's not novel, it's not terribly exciting or different, but what was particular about this intervention was the thoroughness of its application and its implementation. So it was a system of day one reporting, of case management coordination, of engaging those at the workplace, whether it was the line managers or whether it was the people who hold the purse strings. And it was working with people. So Paul in the keynote referred to working with the client in the NDIS scheme. Well, this is about working with the worker. So it is, what is it that they need within boundaries, but what can be done to help them? And that varied. It is kind of like saying, what is insurance or what is an actuarial analysis? Here are five list of dot points that the intervention dealt with, but clearly when you're dealing with people in complex matters, we could spend a couple of days talking about this. I won't talk at the moment about a comparison of somebody who's had a knee injury, but I'll come back to that later. So the study was done across varying industries. It was actually a real-life intervention, and we were lucky enough to have WorkSafe provide data so we could study the intervention across all organisations where it was in place, and they were medium to large-sized companies. So the intersection of looking after people and outcomes comes through really the next few slides. So claims costs in the intervention group clearly dropped by about 40%. Those are average claims costs. Days off work were the key, was the key change. So there was a bit of a drop in the control companies and obviously a substantive drop in the days off work in the intervention companies. Medical costs, you can see as per the slides. And the intervention was effective across varying industries. The intervention was most effective in companies that already had a base of good care for their staff, organisations with good levels of social capital. And so looking at the case example I referred to here earlier, could I ask what you guys do? Are you in actuarial environments? Administering? Are you case managing? Yep. Cool. Anything else? Academic? Thanks, Vicky. So it's a bit hard, I think, when you're working at a big picture sphere, a big picture level, to look at what actually happens down at the coalface, to look at the individual cases. And individual cases, of course, make up the actuarial results, but you don't necessarily see the things that Alan was talking about earlier, the nuances. And so here's a real-life example. So a person has a knee injury at work, twists falling over a pallet, and under the current system, they'll go to their doctor, they might have some physio, they might then be referred to an orthopod, and they might end up having their knee arthroscopy for a cartilage tear at 3 months. And when we would talk to people in organisations about this, they'd say, yes, that was me, except it wasn't 3 months, it was five. And, of course, then a certain percentage of those people would get back to work. Well, within this system, this intervention, those people with that knee injury and a big swollen knee, medically obvious, something's wrong, you know, if we have their MRI scan day two or day three, get them into the good orthopod, they're having their arthroscopy in a week, and then they're much more prepared to go back to work. 5 minutes. And so the working principles here, to press the right button, the working principles here are to work with people, to get the employer involved and to establish trust. So when we would go into organisations, we'd try and find things that we could do to make a difference. Was somebody waiting for an appointment? And could we hasten that? What could we do to get in and help them? And at the end of it, we made quite a big effort to get supervisors involved, but the results really were a development of cooperation. So we had supervisors at the beginning of such interventions who'd say, well, you can't just let all the claims be accepted, we'll have an avalanche. Two, supervisors who were into the swing of, yes, we're loving them. Yes, we're loving them. And that trust that then built up at the workplace was filtered out. So we really had problems with doctors. As I talked to various groups, doctors are often complained about, but we really had problems because the doctor is looking after the patient, and if the patient wants to go back to work, the doctor will generally be cooperative. We talk about the medical model of managing return to work, and as a medico, I see how well that works in some situations and how poorly it works in other situations. And so we perhaps could look at the reciprocity model. So employees will behave in a way that their employer has treated them. And similarly, the compensation system does not treat many people well. And we are not surprised then when they become disenfranchised. So going back to the title, there are huge opportunities to build better outcomes for workers and at the same time build better outcomes for schemes. And on that note, I'll hand over to questions.
All right, great. Thanks very much. I think we've got time for one or two questions at the most. If you'd like to have a question, I can either bring the microphone to you or you can use the microphone in the middle. Any questions?
Tweeting and oh look, thank you so much, you two radical thinkers, for what you're proposing. I just want to make sure I've understood it, because I'm really interested in how you're thinking about social capital and just exactly what you mean. And it seems to me that you're saying that the Mary explicitly said we can't rely on the medical model alone, we need to think about all of these other resources that are available to us, and then Alan, because you define social capital in terms of resources such as networks and trust and relationships, it seemed to me that you were looking at it in two ways. You were looking at it as we need to use other resources to build social capital if we're going to get results. But I'm also interested in the fact that if we think about social capital, we're probably going to do return to work better and therefore get broader social capital. You know, there's a kind of a number of different ways of looking at it. I wonder if you could just come back to, at the end of the day, what you mean when you're talking about social capital in this context.
I'll quickly respond from my perspective. I look at social capital as the asset. So I'm not looking at it from the societal, from the kind of Now, I'm looking at it from the hard benefit that comes from working together. So the financial benefit of doing that, and that runs in parallel with the human benefit.
Similarly, though I differ from Mary a little bit, I think social capital is a type of lubricant which, when it is done well, when it aligns with other elements, with networks and the like, is a facilitator. You can have the type of close-knit village where there are forms of social capital, and in Robert Putnam's Italian example, where in northern Italy the civic involvement is a facilitative, but in southern Italy, where the type of amoral familism of no nepotism, which in a sense is a form of social capital, is inhibiting that social improvement. So I see it in a spectrum, some of which is facilitative, but there are some elements which can be negative. But in terms of following on what Paul O'Connor said, I think we actually need to look very hard at the way we have with ischologically based systems, causation, rather than what are the needs which are brought forth because of that, and collapsing a lot of these silos. Because the one thing about social cost and injury cost, it doesn't go away. It's either borne by the person, it's taken on by the system, or it's transferred onto another system. And I think what we're seeing so much in Australian workers' compensation are the state and territory-based systems wanting to transfer a lot of that cost onto other schemes. And I think I also had the privilege of sitting down with Owen Woodhouse a couple of months ago, and he is at 97 as sharp as a tack and is still pushing for an integrated, humane, comprehensive approach.
Great. Thanks very much, Alan, and also thanks very much, Mary. Please, if you can join your hands together for our speakers.